welcome to episode 71 of the Sports Geek Podcast. On this week's podcast, I catch up with Fiona Green to discuss data capture, CRM, and all things sports. And on ABC Grandstand, Francis and I discuss the year that was and some trends for 2015.
Welcome to the Sports Geek Podcast, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host, who is standing by for your tweetage. Yes, that's a word he made up, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, tweetage is a word I made up. Send in your tweets either to me at Sean Callanan or to at SportsGeek. Tell us where you're listening, what you are listening to. If you're listening to this episode, episode 71. Really appreciate all the tweets that I do get promoting the show, and it's part of the reason I continue to do it and also continue to get new listeners. Thank you very much for some recent iTunes reviews going well, tracking to get 100 iTunes reviews across the podcast that I'm doing. Thanks to Davo, Ross, and Ben for your reviews in the last week. You can go to sportsgeekhq.com/iTunes to leave a review. I'm going to be really quick on the intro on this episode because I've got to have a really good chat with Fiona Green from Winners, discussing sports CRM, data capture, and some of the things you can do to improve your data position, I guess is probably a good way of putting it, inside your sports organization, as well as different ways to capture that data. One more plug before I get into the interview. I've set up the Sports Business Melbourne meetup group. If you're in Melbourne, please join the group. We're going to meet. I'm organizing meetup on the 16th, just a little bit of a Christmas catch-up, but hopefully running these a little more regularly in 2015 than I have in previous years, or in this year at least. That's it from me. Thank you very much for listening, and here is my interview, or my chat, I should say, really, with Fiona Green from Winners. Very happy to welcome a former guest of the Sports Geek podcast back to talk a little bit more about CRM in the sports world. Fiona Green, founder of Winners, a CRM and business intelligence consultancy based out of the UK and a good mate of mine. Welcome back to the podcast, Fiona.
Thank you, Sean, and thank you very much for having me back.
Yeah, I had to restore the CRM balance in my world after having Russell come back on the show to discuss CRM. We've been bouncing backwards and forwards via email after that discussion on a few different topics. So I thought it would be a good time to get you back and one, get your take on SEAT. First time we spoke back in episode 32. It was the first time we'd actually spoken. We'd been connected online. But then you were lucky enough to catch up in real life, and everyone knows who listens to the podcast, I'm a big fan of meeting people in real life that I've connected with online at SEAT in Miami. I guess that's going to be my opening question. What was your thoughts and experiences in the CRM track? Because I wasn't able to go into that track with the digital side of things.
Yeah, my whole SEAT experience was fantastic. Really, really loved it. And what I was bowled over by, and you're probably going to say, yeah, of course, that's what it's all about, is the collaboration.
Yep.
I mean, real collaboration. Just as an example, I was speaking to Greenfall, who's been a sponsor there for some time, apparently. Yep. And, of course, they're a UK-based company. And I was talking to them about, you know, one of the hard things about being a sponsor at SEAT is people don't want to talk to you because they think you're going to try and sell them something, which is the way the exhibitors and the sponsors in the UK have tended to be viewed sometimes by the participants. And the gentleman from Greenfall will say, no, it's the total opposite at SEAT, because the way Christine and her team, including you, have set this up to be all about collaboration and knowledge share, that, you know, the sponsors aren't viewed as that people are interested to talk to them. And more importantly, the sponsors are interested to share, you know, to share their knowledge, share their insight. And listening to Russell speak on your podcast recently, he was talking about, you know, when he's now over at Core and he's seen best practice across a whole ton of teams and across the major sports, he's getting to see the same thing, best practice in each of the different leagues or franchises, and share them around. So that was the key takeaway for me for SEAT. I just thought it was the level of knowledge share and collaboration was superb. very excited about that. Within the CRM track, really, really enjoyed it and got to meet Paul Greenberg and Russell and obviously yourself, who I've been following and interacting with for some time. I think the biggest thing that I took away with me from a negative standpoint is that there's still an awful lot of emphasis on CRM being a system, CRM being a software, and there was a heavy emphasis on CRM as a product to help you move your sales pipeline.
Yep.
And I think the term CRM has gone on to mean so much more than that, but it's more about systems and it's more about processes and strategy, with CRM software or CRM system being the technology.
So do you want to? Sorry. No, that's all right. Do you want to sort of dive into that a little bit around the system? You know, forget the systems and the technology for a moment. And what do you mean by the process and strategy behind it?
Well, for a start, I remember being on one of the panels. I was lucky enough to either host or be part of three panels, and I was asked a question. And it must have been relating to the systems or the technology. And I said, look, if you only have 2,000 customers, do everything on Excel. And somebody in the audience, they came up to me afterwards and they were like, they said, we tweeted, I can't believe Fiona Green has said do it on Excel. But then I met somebody for Madison Square Gardens who is an ex-IBM person who nailed it in one sentence for me. She said, look, if you can't do it manually, you can't automate it.
Yep.
So, you know, we tend to be of the thought process that figure out what you want to achieve, figure out what tools you currently have, and then figure out the way to achieve it. You don't have to go straight from I'm thinking CRM to what system do I buy? And as I say to us, we talk about in our approach to CRM, and it's not unique, I'm sure other practitioners use this as well, we talk about the CRM perfect circle, and that it's made up of five elements, and each element is as important as the other. So there's strategy, culture, process, data, and technology. And so while technology is important, it's an enabler. You've still got to have the data as a foundation. You've still got to have the strategy, so know what you're doing. You still have to have processes in place. And you still have to have that cultural buy-in. You still have to have got rid of your silos, your cultural silos, because CRM is an enterprise-wide or a business-wide strategy. It doesn't sit with just within ticketing or membership or fan clubs or hospitality or sponsorship. It needs to work across the whole organisation. It's not endemic just to the states or to the attendees of SEAT. I think that's just in general where the term CRM sits because of its foundation, where it came from, the Siebel guys, etc.
Yeah.
But I think it's still a bit of a legacy at the moment. That's something I'd like to try and shake off.
Yeah, I do like that idea from a point of view of learn how to do it manually before automating, because yeah, there's a lot of there's with so many tools on offer, and we see the same in the digital space. There's so many things you can do to automate. Automate processes, whether it be responses or campaigns and things like that. But if you haven't done the process yourself and understand why you're automating it, you can jump to that solution too quickly, think, oh, that's great, we can get that off our plate. But maybe it, you know, if you haven't tested that it works and that's what your fans want, then it's not going to hit the mark.
And if you haven't, and also if you haven't understood how you look at the data or how you look at the different data feeds or whatever it is that you're looking at, and understood how it's going to get you to your end game, how is it going to get you to that actionable insight? Because you're used to just creating a formula or clicking a couple of buttons. If you haven't actually understood why X plus Y equals Z, mm-hmm. then you're just being taught how to use a tool, how to use a piece of software. So I guess that was one of my key takeaways. I also, probably because I sold sponsorship for many, many, many years before moving into CRM, and therefore I understand the value that the business intelligence, that the data insights can provide you in your sponsorship sales process, and indeed in your sponsorship leverage environment, I think, again, when I was trying to talk CRM and its role in sponsorship, there was still too much focus on CRM software helping with the sales pipeline.
Yep.
And I really wanted to try and talk the use of the analytics and the BI to help you target the right sponsors, but more importantly, help the sponsors get more return on investment. So I hope that next year there might be more talk around that side of things as opposed to the software and the systems. But my goodness me, you know, you stand up and you get the opportunity to hear Paul Greenberg speak, and, you know, you get to hear the San Francisco 49ers. You get to hear so many of these elite sports organizations, coupled with some software providers, coupled with some smaller sports properties, sharing best practice. It's just superb. You know, got some great learnings from it. It was superb.
Terrific. So for those, so going back to the Excel discussion, and I remember, I think it was in Kansas City, it was Bobby Whitson was talking about that, you know, even with the CRM systems are being used, there's still a lot of practitioners, you know, doing data extracts out of, you know, the tools, whatever it might be, because they can't analyze or crunch the data as well as they could, and still putting it into Excel, into those smaller data sets, to be able to do the reports and analyze the data. So it's not like the tool can do everything. So there's still a place to be able to get your hands dirty and look at that data and analyze it yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, we were with a client earlier this year, and we were doing a workshop for them when we were trying to get them from their current state to their next stage. And before, of course, we do a workshop, we assess the current resources they have, the current tools, the current capacity to grow, spend, or whatever the term is. And, of course, our workshop is based on using what you have now but helping you get to the next level. And we did some RFV analysis, recency, frequency, and value. It was for a football organization, a soccer organization. It was to help them understand and identify who their most valuable and less valuable or lower value customers are, and to help them understand, are your most valuable customers the ones that come once and spend a fortune?
Yep.
Or those that come regularly and spend a smaller amount? So we had the customer base, and we had, I think, 5 years of transactional history, which was great. And we presented them with their RFE analysis, and we showed them what percentage fitted into the different segments. And we profiled, you know, their top three in each segment, et cetera, et cetera. And the head of IT was sat there with a bit of a smirk on his face. And I remember finally saying to him, why are you looking at me like that? Why are you, you know, pulling such a sort of half grin? And he says, because I'm waiting for you to tell me how much the software costs that allowed you to do all that. And I said, we did it in Excel.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just was blown away. He couldn't believe it. But so we showed him how to do it.
But it is the expectation that there's these black box magic tools that can solve it. And sometimes, you know, it's machine learning is getting better and all of that kind of stuff, but we're not at that artificial intelligence type of space where it can just take a big chunk of data and come back. We still need that interpretation from an analyst's point of view.
And that's why there are so many horror stories, and you Google the term CRM and you see so many posts about CRM going wrong, and it's because people have perhaps relied on buying a piece of software and it changing their lives. But you still need to have all the other things in place, understand what you want to use it for, what do you want to achieve, make sure you've got the processes in place, make sure you've got the data and it's clean and it's lined up, and make sure you've got the culture that wants to embrace the output of a CRM system. The technology is just one piece of it.
So I want to sort of dive into those metrics that you were looking at around recency, frequency, and value. How has, from a social point of view and social media and the interaction that fans have, is that now, are you bringing that into the equation, or is that recency and frequency still based on pure transactions or pure attendance? Like, are the formulas changing? Because obviously, you know, from a value point of view, if I tweet a lot about the team, it's not the same as if I buy merchandise or bring a ticket, but it is having some effect. Is that Is that getting into that equation some way?
At the moment, when it comes to recency, frequency, value, we're following the retail model, that the value comes from the actual transactional spend. I think the value of a tweet or the value of a like is a whole nother conversation that needs to take place. Although personally, I think that conversation time has been and gone, and I'm not dismissing social media. I think it's great. You know, it's an outer layer
to that transactional stuff.
And it's brilliant at creating noise, excitement, traffic, interest, etc., engagement. But it doesn't provide you with insight. It doesn't provide you with data because, rightly so, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, etc., YouTube, they give you these tools for free. And oh my goodness, they are great tools. But ultimately, you have a price to pay, and that's you don't get the data, you don't get the insight. I heard Paul Rodgers speak. He's head of international for Liverpool Football Club's digital, and he said, "You know, we spent all this money chasing our fans onto our social media platforms. Now we've got to spend more money to use them." He said, "So instead, we're trying to get them back out of social media onto our website, using the social media channels to drive them back to our website." And he said, you know, your number one asset is your website, and that's got to be the focus of everything. That's where you can collect data. That's where you can sell products. So we were with Seven League yesterday, globally renowned digital agency focusing on sport, and they brought up the next development within Twitter to allow purchases within the Twitter stream.
Yep.
And they were saying, and they were giving this example of a sports organization selling tickets through Twitter. And the customer asked, well, then who gets the data? And of course, Seven League says, well, Twitter are going to, because that's their model. And I said, but, you know, how can they do that? Because ultimately, the sports organization is providing the physical asset. Twitter's not the customer. It's not Twitter that's buying the ticket from the sports organization. It's the customer using Twitter as the channel. And for example, when you compare that to Ticketmaster, even though Ticketmaster providing the channel, depending on how you negotiate your contract with Ticketmaster, of course, Ticketmaster will still allow the customer to be yours or to be shared.
Yeah.
And of course, that's probably not going to happen with Twitter, is it? We don't know. I guess it remains to be seen.
It is part of the development. And I think, I did a recent podcast on Beers Blokes Business on Trends. And for mine, social commerce is going to be a real big trend next year. So, so Richard Ayres and the guys at Seven League are right. Twitter is bringing out a buy button. So you'll be able to open up a tweet and see a button. You'll be able to hit buy. You know, you'll have your credit card with Twitter. I mean, that's a big trust thing. Are people going to give their credit card to Twitter to be able to enact these transactions? That's the first hurdle that Twitter have. And then you could buy that piece of merch. But ticketing is such a complex beast. You know, it's not like you're going to be able to pick your seat, decide where you're going to sit, buy two of the tickets. It's not going to work on Twitter. So both Facebook and Twitter are going to move into that social commerce space where a simple buy now button. The idea is that you're still going to have to get the data. The data is going to flow through. So they will just be a channel for you to advertise effectively. But the data will eventually come through to you, and so I guess
it will.
The data that will be important from your point of view and the ticketing people point of view will be the source of those leads and the source of that kind of that those transactions to find out we are getting those leads and those sales via social means. But completely agree with you on Paul's point of. You know, your website's still your home base. All these channels that are out there are really just that. They're just ways to fish in the pond that is Facebook or that is Twitter. You always got to make sure you have a strategy to get them back to your site, but then also get them into your system.
Exactly.
Point of view, which is what I wanted to ask you about. You're being experienced and you'll do an assessment of an organization's, I guess, data position of what data they have and what opportunities they have to get more data and looking at how teams, leagues, anybody really can go and acquire more data as part of, you know, data capture applications. And, you know, I've had the question posed to me a few times. I wanted your opinion on what's the best method to go and acquire data if you're just pushing it out to your fans. Is it best to follow the trends of Facebook single sign-on, you know, so a sign-up with Facebook button, so it takes your details, you know, Fiona Green, it takes your email from Facebook, and then potentially it might ask for a few other things, you know, it might ask for your birth date, and it might ask for your friends list, and it might ask for other things. Or is it just better to just have the, here's your email, you know, fill out this form, here's your email, here's a submit button, and we're starting at that low point of just getting, you know, the basic information of email, maybe phone, mobile phone, and starting from there. Is there something that you're seeing that is a trend in that space of how to go and get the data?
I don't know if I'm seeing a trend. I can tell you what our position is, what Winner's position is. As with anything that you do in this space, marketing, digital or otherwise, there's no one answer because there's no one customer with one style of operating.
Oh, that doesn't make it good for everybody. Everyone just wants one answer, Fiona. I'm only joking.
So to answer your first part, social logins, we call them, as opposed to single sign-ons. Single sign-ons for us are when you use one entry to manage your relationship across the site, even if there are other parties providing solutions to it. But anyway, so social logins via, you know, Facebook, Google Plus, etc. No, we're a big fan of them. The way you set them up is you can actually, you can only take the data that the social channel user has made public.
Yep.
But you can also force, you know, as a required field, additional data that they might not have made public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great tool. And when you use social logins, you don't just get the data they've made public. Of course, you get their handle or name or whatever it is.
User ID, yep.
Yeah, the thing you need to be aware of is if somebody uses a social login and they fall into your database and you communicate with them, but then they cancel their Facebook account, for example, then you just need to ensure your website terms and conditions have taken that into account,
mm-hmm.
that just because they cancel their Facebook account and you collected their data via that way, you've still got the right to use their data, or you may want to give up the right to use that data. It's entirely up to you.
Yep.
But the point is you're using a different channel to collect that data. So that's important to have covered. But I mean, there are so many tools out there. Twitter, well, you taught me about one of them, the lead generation cards.
Yeah.
I mean, we've on Twitter, we've used that with a number of clients. It's great. I mean, goodness me, so easy. And the fact it's free. Twitter, what are you doing? Are you crazy? So, yeah.
Well, they
and
don't
then
tell
just,
anybody. Like, that's
yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. You told me. Yeah. Do you know how many people I've told, Sean? And they're, you know, huge digital marketers, and they didn't know about it either. So, and of course, within Facebook, you have an app where you can build a data collection form to feed straight into your CRM.
Yep.
But then on top of that, you can build a data collection form, host it on your website, host it wherever you want, and just take the URL and put it into your social feeds. So, you know, there are so many different ways to collect data.
Yeah,
and it's better to use them all, to be frank.
Because, it is a matter of testing. I guess the main thing I'm finding is that especially around the privacy discussion around, you know, not necessarily the abuse of privacy, but how people are changing and framing the way that they want to be seen. I think a couple of years ago with the Facebook sign-in, people would have asked for a lot of things. And I think that's where there is potentially some pushback because you can ask for a lot of permissions. You can ask for, you know, birthday, access to friends, you know, see all their likes, all of that kind of stuff. And it's very rich from a data point of view. But I think people are starting to wise up a little bit of, oh, hang on, why does Team X need to know what other pages I like and where I've checked in and things like that? And so it's pretty much the case of, you know, would you provide them with a large sign-up form that asks them, you know, 20 questions just because it's easy to go and grab that data. You don't want to go and give a reason for them to not complete the sign-up. I know when I, you know, I'm doing it from a analysis of what people are doing point of view, but I just shake my head sometimes when I see when it is just simply a lead acquisition that they're acquiring far too much data for what they're asking for. And it's about getting that balance right.
So, we have our views on this are quite simple. Firstly, on what data you acquire, well, what data do you need? Let's start with your objectives here because, you know, data for data's sake, nobody needs that. The second thing is it's a value exchange. If you're giving your fans or customers or stakeholders something, then they'll give you something back. You've just got to find what the level is. Now, the way we view data to support your CRM and your business intelligence is there's three ways to get it. There's to ask the customer through whatever method you want to use, competition, surveys, etc. There's watch their behavior, whether it's transactional, event-related, online, whatever. It's their behavioral data. And then there's the third one, which is third parties. You know, these data warehouses out there, these marketing data warehouses that do collate data, and you can run your database through them and see what tags and, you know, demographics and things like that they can add on to the end of it. So, you know, when it comes to, for example, a registration form or a login needing an email address and a date of birth and gender and this and that and the other, we just pull it back and say, what is it you're trying to achieve? So let's start at that point. What do we need to do to achieve that?
Yep.
The other thing is this is the digital world. We can be flexible. We can try something.
Yeah.
And if in a couple of months or a couple of weeks or whatever your test phase is, it's not working, we can switch strategy. We're doing that with a client at the moment. They're doing an online vote. There's no competition element, there's no prize, but because of the product, because of what the project is about, it's so internationally compelling. We're seeing we're doing it in two phases: free to vote and post your favorite whatever.
Yep.
And then halfway through the campaign, we're going to switch to a forced registration.
Yep.
So at the start, there's a registration. You can decide whether to do it or not. And then we're going to force the registration and we're going to see the difference, not in the difference in participation, because we will expect to see a natural drop off because of the length of time the campaign's been running, but a difference in the people that enter the process but then don't finally submit because of the forced registration.
Yep.
So we're going to see what the ratio is on people actually going through with it and just test it. And, you know, that's what CRM is all about, isn't it? It's learning from the actions that you do to inform your future actions.
Yeah. I mean, testing is paramount, especially with from a data point of view and the data capture side. So, you know, simple things like A-B testing, those kind of forms, you know, putting, you know, taking a sample of your audience, sending 100 people one form and 100 people another form to test which one works better, then before you send it out to your 10,000 in your database, it can make a massive change in what type of data gets collected.
We were with a client talking about the role of social media in a CRM strategy, and we used this term that for them, we want to move them from vanity metrics to business metrics.
Yep.
But it might be that on some occasions, some campaigns, some objectives, it is more about numbers.
Yep.
But then at another time, it might be more about the depth of the data, not the quantity. So, you know, it you have to work with whatever your objectives are for that particular process or that particular campaign.
Terrific, terrific. I did want to one of the things that I'm still working with a couple of different stadiums around is around the stadiums trying to get a better understanding of their fan, and it's a different proposition than a team point of view, in that they've got to provide the utilities that we expect of a stadium, and one of those is now becoming Wi-Fi, and that's sort of opening up I guess the access to fans for the stadiums. Do you think that's a natural play for stadiums to get more information on their customers by, you know, asking for a login when you're connecting with their Wi-Fi, as long as they're providing services you know, on that Wi-Fi, whether it be wayfinding or customer service or added features because they're providing that infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, the way we look at Network Stadium, I mean, it's a fantastic subject of discussion. And again, another observation from my time in seat, which you and I have discussed before, was that in the States, it's a case of not if it's going to happen, but when are we doing it? When are we going to network this stadium?
Or it's a must. So,
We must do it. Certainly over here in Europe, we seem to be a lot more cautious than that, apart from certain pockets.
Yep.
Norway, for some reason, are, you know, stealing a march. It's still for us, are we actually going to do it? For me, when it comes to, you know, putting aside the direct return on investment potential, the direct upsales or whatever, just getting access to that data that we've never had before in terms of the fans' behaviour in the stadium.
On top
of that, you know, for some organisations where they can still allow one person to buy four tickets or six tickets or whatever, if you haven't got an access control system, you don't know who those are the five attendees are. Mm-hmm. You only know the name of the ticket buyer. So, you know, Wi-Fi is going to make the user experience more pleasurable. You know, when we talk to some people, they say, no, they should be watching the game, not playing on the phones. But this is what the people want.
Yeah.
You know, whenever I talk to people, I ask them, do you remember that brand Kodak? Mm. They stood their ground and they said, digital film will not work.
Yeah.
It has to be. And you know, where's the Kodak brand now? And we're not saying that a stadium that doesn't implement Wi-Fi will go bust and become a memory. But if the customers want Wi-Fi, they're going to go where there's Wi-Fi.
Yep.
And if they feel they're only losing a margin of the experience by staying at home and watching it, but at least they can tweet and Facebook and bet and whatever, then they're going to do that, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's the corner that that stadiums are being painted in. I think the US is ahead of the curve because that's where their demand is. You know, it's an entertainment option, and they expect to be able to look at replays or you know, communicate and text and go backwards and forwards with fans. Where, you know, in the UK, and we have seen the pushback of, we don't want Wi-Fi, it wrecks the experience. You should be involved with the game. You know, they do consume their sport differently, so they're not reaching for their phones as much. But there are it's the new consumer. It's the next 10 years of consumer that have lived in a world that is only mobile, that internet is always available, that they won't want to go into a black hole for 2 hours. It's inconceivable for them. And you know, I joke that, you know, if I took the internet off my kids, who are both teenagers, you know, they would just start getting the shakes.
Yeah.
You know, it's the best way to get the attention of your teenager is to turn off the Wi-Fi. And then it pulls them out of their room and go, well, what's happening? The world has stopped spinning. So, you know, that's effectively how the sports fan is feeling.
Well, it's in Maslow's hierarchy of needs now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
That base level. But back to your original question about expecting people to hand over the data in return for free service. Maybe I'm looking at this too simplistically because I work in the industry.
Yep.
But if I was a customer or a fan, I'd think, well, sure, you can have my data. But by the way, the minute I leave the stadium, I will unsubscribe or I will write to you and say I want to retract it, because the Data Protection Act, whatever country you're in, is so tight that if people want to opt out at a later date, you have to allow them to.
Yeah.
So,
and I think I asked the question because I think that time is almost past. Like, I think, you know, there's so much, you know, free Wi-Fi. Like, if you go to different cafes or, you know, conference halls or exhibition building, like, you know, they just don't bother now to go, oh, I'm going to give you Wi-Fi, give over my email, because especially if it's a transient, you know, transaction. If you go to a hotel for a conference and you sign up for their free Wi-Fi and you have to give your email, you know, you're in Miami once. You know, you don't want emails from that hotel, you know, every time. So people will do exactly what you said, unsubscribe. But I think the thing is, from a stadium point of view, is they have to provide exceptional value, whether it be via their app and there's a way to attract your data via the app and start that conversation with your fan that way, rather than just saying, we're giving you something and, you know, give us your email in return. You've got to really over-index on the value that you're delivering to the fan, so they actually want to opt in.
I think you're right. I think I like that term, over-index on the value. I think the only thing I would say to counter that is, at least we have, even with venues where you're not talking a team or a league or you know, a club or a team, you still have the fact that they go into that venue and they're going to have, especially if they're watching a sports event, there is going to be an element of passion and excitement. So I think the propensity to opt in, or the propensity to give data, is greater within a sports environment because it's passion. You go to check into a hotel, you don't feel excited about Hilton or Holiday Inn. You're watching your favourite team play, or you're watching your favourite sport live. It generates passion and interest, so it's easier. For me, I take the view that it's easier to entice the data. But as you say, only if you're over-indexing on the value. You have to be providing something for it.
So one other question I have for you, because, you know, the big part of CRM is the first part, the customer. But what about all the other data that is abound, that is byproduct of that customer data, that's not attached to a record? So, you know, some of the data that stadiums have is people logging into the network, seeing what people are doing while they're on that network, whether they're pulling content in by, you know, consuming content, or whether they're pushing it out by, you know, sharing photos and videos to heat maps of the stadium, to what does the data look like from a Facebook point of view, because you can do a whole bunch of analysis on the analytics and effectively say, well, this is what our Facebook fan looks like according to Zuck. Does that match? How much work do you do in looking at that other data to sort of get a fuller picture, but a different picture of comparing it with the actual data you do have from a customer level point of view?
We as a business haven't got into that area, that sort of unstructured data. It clearly has a value, without a shadow of a doubt, to help inform decisions. So, for example, the heat maps of where people are around a stadium or around the area surrounding a stadium is going to be incredibly useful, not just to your health and safety guys and your parking attendants, but also to your commercial guys who try and figure out, how do we get these people into the stadium earlier? Yep. To feed them, etc. It's not an area we've been involved in, but clearly it's got a lot of value. Our focus has been on aligning data with individuals, creating those customer personas, etc. But, you know, there's so much other data out there that's of value. It's not within Winner's current business model. Is it within yours then, Sean? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, effectively, yeah. Like, you know, when people are sort of embarking on a data project, one of the things they're looking for is, where can we get this data, and what current data do we have? Because, you know, when people are starting out, they might say, oh, we've got this data. It might be our membership data or our data from ticketing. And so that's a good base point. But then they're saying, well, we need to grow that. And I'm always looking at the opportunity ponds that social offers, and the fact that, you know, Facebook, if we're looking at the primary one where most people will have a fan base, does give you, you know, demographic information off of that.
Yeah.
It does give you profiles of your fans. Like, we're doing a lot of analysis on that side of, of the thing for the sponsorship guys, to be able to say, you know, do you want to know how many people who work in this industry are fans of you, that kind of stuff. But it also presents, well, that's an opportunity. So going back to Paul's point from Liverpool, you know, if you're trying to drag them back into your system, well, at least you know, well, we're going to target these fans. If we're going to roll out a campaign, we're going to do it to people who are, you know, over 30, that are specific, you know, that are in those personas that you define, because you can map them onto your social profiles and run campaigns to require more of them. If you find out, and, you know, using your recency, frequency, value proposition to say, this is the type of fan that we want because we know that they spend, you know, this much when we do acquire them, you can go out and acquire them. And so that's the thing. There's Facebook audiences. There's the same from a Google Analytics point of
view. I was just going to say that. I mean, the number one free tool that we all have access to is Google Analytics for your website. And it's great because you can understand what content's important, you know, from your bounce rates, from your, you know, your customer journey, et cetera. But where we like to step in is when that data isn't just random, that it's actually aligned with individuals themselves. Because, you know, we're part of the mantra, getting the right message to the right person at the right time, and actually to get what you want, to increase optimum yield, blah, blah, blah. But we also used to say the right message to the right person at the right time on the right channel or via the right channel.
Yeah.
But of course, I'm not going to use that dreaded word that I get criticized for when I use it and that Paul Greenberg also hates, but that, you know, the fact that people are channel blind now, they don't really have a channel. It's whatever device, whatever thing they happen to be holding in their hand at the time.
I thought you were going to use omni-channel.
I just said I wasn't going to use it. I used it the other day. Yeah. Somebody tweeted, I can't believe Fiona Green just used that word.
Omnichannel. It's like you tick it off when you go to a conference, someone's talking about CRM or retail. It's like we're tackling omnichannel. And you just nod and go, of course you are.
So to our point, you know, it's about the right message, the right person at the right time. Whereas when you're using unstructured data, when you're using generic Google Analytics or Facebook data, it's just you're just getting an overview, and there is value in that overview, but you're not applying that statistic or that pattern or that persona to a particular person.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can analyze that type of stuff forever and a day. You've got to apply something. You've got to run a campaign that says we are going to tackle this, or we're going to use that data in some way. And so at the moment, you know, we're using the data in sponsorship acquisition to sort of say this is a profile of our fans if we haven't got a savvy enough profile in our database. But the idea is you want to get them into your database so you can get actually a more concrete picture probably the main thing.
And then allow those sponsors to be part of your campaign to actually target them.
Definitely.
Especially, you know, it's perfect for sponsors that have a particular target market or target markets as opposed to the mass marketers. But if you can tell your Mercedes-Benz dealer how many of the, you know, the high net worth individuals you have, or ditto, you can tell your Volkswagen dealer how many young racer boys they have. You know, it's that type of approach. Yep. Heineken notoriously target 18 to 25-year-old males.
Yep.
So, you know, let's show them how many we have and how we're going to integrate their message into our campaigns in a relevant fashion.
Yep. One thing I did want to ask you, coming up this March in London, Christine is taking the Seat Travelling Circus over to the UK. It's going to be at Lords. Looking forward to bringing the Seat experience to your hometown.
Yeah, very much so. I'm very excited to be a part of it, and really interested to see how we replicate that collaborative knowledge share position here. And of course, we're starting with the 49ers, so that's going to be great. Yeah, it'll be really interested and really interesting. I'm looking forward to it. And of course, I'm also booked in already to go to San Francisco. My hotel room and my flights are booked.
Oh, terrific. You're better organised than me. I've got my hotel room, but I'm still making some plans. I'm going to do a tour prior to Seat with some Aussie sports executives. The spots are filling up, so please send me an email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com, if you're listening and want to come along. We're going to go to Seattle and Portland before going to Seat and catch up with a few friends from the Seat community, and then head to San Francisco to make a little bit bigger trip. So I'm looking forward to that. But Seat London, will be one day. The 49ers are headlining and talking about all the things that they're doing at Levi's Stadium. But if you're a CIO, CTO, looking at these technology problems, you definitely should be attending. And yeah, we'd love to see some CRM and digital folk turn up as well, because the idea is to see this be a success and hopefully expand it in the same way that Seat has expanded over the last couple of years with dedicated CRM and digital tracks. But you're right, it's the collaboration component of Seat that Christine does so well, and if that can be done in in London, and I know with, you know, having you there and guys like Dennis Mills, who's been to a few and is working it with major events, you know, it should be a good event. So you can go to sportsgeekhq.com/SEAT London. We'll send you to the right place. And follow SEAT on all different channels. There'll be links in the show notes as always. So until that time, have a good Christmas season.
Oh my gosh!
It's not far away.
Sean, you're the first person to say that to me.
Oh well, it's December and it's sort of getting in that space. So I thought I would do that. So have a great Christmas, and I'm sure I'll talk to you over the new year.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time. Cheers, Sean.
Sign up for the Sports Geek News at sportsgeekhq.com/SGN.
Thanks again to Fiona Green there from Winners. You can send her a tweet, FionaGreen66. What are your thoughts? I did want to follow up on one of the things we did discuss in that chat was using Twitter cards. You can use Twitter cards without using advertising. It's a little known fact. Twitter is not actually advertising that fact too much because they want you to spend the ads. But simply go into the ads component of Twitter. Go to ads.twitter.com. And in your account there, and if you can't see Twitter cards because you haven't set up and handed over a credit card yet, just put /cards after your account detail. It'll be like accounts and then a little code for what your account is. Put cards, and then you can create a card. So even if you haven't got a great CRM that has hooks in it, like I'm using with MailChimp, you can do things like set up Twitter cards for people to install your apps. And it will show the Google Play to Android users and the Apple to Apple users. So have a play with it, see what you do. Use it to promote specific content, ticket offers, those kind of things. And once you've got the link of the Twitter card set up, you can put it on as many tweets as you like. So as I said, you don't have to run an ad. You can to obviously boost that. But you can just use it in replies to fans or things like that. So send me your Twitter card. Show me what you're using those Twitter cards for. There's a whole bunch that are available there in the Twitter ads product. And as I said, you don't have to actually use them as an ad. I caught up with Francis Lees for the last time on ABC Grandstand this week to look back at the year it was and look at some of the trends for next year.
Francis Lynch with you, and love catching up with our good friend Sean Callanan from Sports Geek HQ, regularly on the program to talk sport in the digital world, and he's here with us again this morning. G'day, Sean, how are you going?
I'm good, thanks, Francis. I'm good.
Quickly racing towards the end of another year.
Yeah, I don't know if it is that digital and everything around us makes the years seem to go much faster, but it definitely felt like this year has just flown by.
And we look back at the great innovations this year in the world of sport and the digital experience. What are some of the things that have stood out? We've talked a lot on this program about enhancing the fan experience using technology. Who's the clubhouse leader, both overseas and here in Australia at the moment?
Yeah. I think what we're seeing is more and more that the technology being at the stadium as a reason to go.
Which is a massive problem, say, in Australia now, isn't it, for AFL clubs that are looking to provide a unique experience for clubs who are using generic venues.
Yeah. So it's sports across the world is in a battle for the couch. You know, you've got the couch, big screen TV, connectivity, all your devices. That's the home experience. And then, the live experience doesn't have that component. And so, you know, that's been the challenge. So we're seeing more and more things, and I think the AFL this year sort of went a little bit too far down the, we're doing the fan engagement, sort of tactics. And they took a lot of the stuff from the US and they've sort of wound a lot of that back and gone sort of back to traditions. But some of the technology that's rolling out, we're just starting to see it, and it was sort of future wear and stuff. Previously, it was things like beacons and which, you know, can tell you what you're doing at particular parts of the stadium and are hooked into the app. I think that's because it's not like Wi-Fi, which has been a constant thing that's been rolling out. That's a big infrastructure, big cost to roll out Wi-Fi, but beacons, they're effectively the size of a 20 cent piece, and they cost about $10. So they can be put anywhere throughout the throughout a stadium. And so we're seeing more and more of that.
So how does the beacon work in a stadium in the States?
It pretty much, you know, the best example I have of it is when you put it anywhere in the States, but you have to have your app enabled to look for these things.
Yep.
So it's a matter of doing a bit of code, you know, getting like my former job as a geek, you know, getting in there to say, keep an eye out for this beacon. And then when you see it, produce this action in the app. And one of the best ones is the Golden State Warriors, when you're going up to the third level of a Golden State Warriors game at Oracle Arena, and then you, so you're going to go up into the, you know, the cheap seats. But if you have the Warriors app at the top of the escalator, they'll have beacons there, and the app will go, oh, hello, Francis, you're on the third level. Would you like to sit in the first level for an upgrade of $100? And it's perfect, you know, context wise, right off the right time. And then it sends you to the app and allows you to upgrade your seat. So that's the best application, both from a fan experience point of view and what they want to do, but it's also, you know, it's the right offer and it fills the seats that are down below. So those kind of things are sort of where they're heading. But from a, you know, a smaller implementation point of view, it can be rolled out and be put into, you know, a special area for, you know, premium Saints members, and you walk into that room, and so the app can say, welcome, thanks a lot, and play a video, you know, of Nick Riewoldt. And you're only getting that because you're a premium member and you're in this specific room.
So it can tailor it very, very specifically for individuals, and that enhances the intimate nature of the experience, which is otherwise fairly generic.
Yeah. And I guess that's where we can, put this digital footprint over a stadium, even if you can't paint the stadium, you know, so we can't paint the MCG or all the stadiums different colours and things like that, but we can do it in a digital form. So I think that's something that, and then the other one that's a bit of a trend is providing content that's specific to the stadium. So as scoreboard screens are getting better and better, you know, the MCG's had an upgrade, and we see the ridiculousness of scoreboards in the US. What Mark Cuban has done at the Dallas Mavericks is installed cameras throughout the arena to allow them to do, the best way to describe it is Matrix-style video replays. So we remember Neo and you know, Hugo Weaving dodging bullets and the camera spinning around. They now provide that in a Mavericks game on the big screen. So the camera will be on the right side seeing Dirk Nowitzki, you know, post up on the 3-point line about to take a shot. And then the camera can pause and it can spin around and take and go to the shot from the baseline and have that whole 3D effect. And it's a real cool, wild type of thing. And you think, oh, that'll be great. But they're only providing it in the stadium. So they've said, sorry, person sitting on the couch, you're getting just a regular TV coverage. If you want this wow factor, and you don't have to pull out your phone to see it, it's going to be on our big screen. It's part of our game entertainment. Come along because it's, you know, it's really cool. So I think that's where some of the trends will go for the next, you know, 12 months.
A major sporting franchise is also using YouTube now as quasi-television stations. Are we seeing more and more empowering of fans by having these industrial-strength YouTube channels?
Yeah, I think the main thing was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago even, there was this misconception of there's the cannibalization of audience of, you know, and that was from broadcasters that had bought rights to the digital partners that had secured the rights to the clubs. When, you know, YouTube is one of, you know, is the biggest video platform on the earth. You know, Facebook is starting to give it a bit of a runs for its money. But what we've seen is teams realize that YouTube is another funnel to find new fans. So, you know, I really like the way that, you know, Arsenal launched their YouTube channel officially this year. And, you know, we've had Richard Clarke on the show before, like, but they're not putting every single piece of content out there. They're putting out, and the way he describes it is the YouTube channel is the personality of the game. And so they're putting out this, the same type of content that people want to see on YouTube. You know, funny videos showing the personality of the players, having a laugh, that kind of thing to that you want to share, that you'll say see as an Arsenal fan and want to share, and it's very shareable rather than even, you know, inside their Arsenal player, which is what they call their home game, their stadium effectively. So we're seeing more and more people put that content out, letting it share, and then it is driving them back. So all the studies are showing if you watch more YouTube clips, then you end up watching more of the full game.
It's about building affinity, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
They're the masters of it.
And it's the same as, you know, why people are on Facebook and on Twitter. It's that's where the people are. So serve the content in those places and then they will come back and want to consume more. So it's about building up that relationship with them.
Also putting a value on the posts of athletes, the ability now to actually quantify the value of, say, a Ronaldo post on Facebook. It now has a, you know, almost a share price, doesn't it? How much have they quantified it, say, a significant Ronaldo post is? If he talks about your product or he mentions your stadium,
yep.
What do they reckon?
Well, I mean, when you have, and this is, you know, when you have 100 million, and I feel like I have to do the Mike Myers, put the little finger in the mouth when I say that. When you have 100 million Facebook fans, you do have a massive global reach. So there was a study done.
You're a broadcast platform all on your own.
Exactly. And that's, you know, and that's not restricted to athletes. We're seeing the same with, you know, comedians doing a terrific job building up their platforms on Twitter and Facebook and things like that, to push out their content. And so, yeah, big brands are seeing the opportunity with footballers, whether it be Ronaldo or Messi. So the study came up and said that a Facebook post by Ronaldo is worth $143,000. But then and you think, wow, that's a lot of money. But then if you think, well, look at the reach and the amount of people that like it, and then compare it to the insane prices of Super Bowl ads, you know, and it's getting close to being in some comparison to say, well, if I'm going to justify spending this on, you know, this ad for 30 seconds that's going to reach this many people, you know, Ronaldo can put out a picture and have like 100, you know, a million likes on a photo in mere hours and reach the globe. So
incredibly empowering for the athlete in terms of their commercial viability.
Well, that's the thing. And I think that's, that's where I think there's a, you know, real big opportunity for athletes. And it's going to be a fine balance because, you know, you don't want to start seeing your athlete doing, you know, product shots in every single social media post, but they will start realising that there is definite value there.
Sean Callanan from Sports Geek HQ talking to us about sport in the digital world. Let's put out your bats at hashtag the most stunning sort of organic digital social campaign this year.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, social media takes a few whacks throughout, you know, in the media at times with athletes' mistakes and things like that. But when something that genuine and organic happens, and it was, you know, Phil Taylor, just a dad in Sydney, just, you know, and was really quick straight after he said, you know, put out your bats as a mark of respect to Philip Hughes, for that to get picked up by people. You know, so it wasn't a media driven thing. It wasn't picked up by Cricket Australia or anything.
There was no Max Markson involved.
No, exactly. There was no promotion of it. It was something that was genuine. People just started doing it. And the fact that it effectively went further than social media, like there was kids who, you know, they're not on Twitter and they're not on, but they heard about it. And, you know, you heard stories of people walking home and seeing, you know, houses and everyone had, you know, bats out. So, and then for it to go viral and, effectively to be done by, people, around the world and the other teams to get involved. It was really a big tick for social to say, you know, it does have the power to do the positive stuff. It doesn't always have to be.
And the funny stuff too. I mean, hashtag Sochi problems was one of the, it was fairly organic. It kind of happened because people were there and dealing with all sorts of madness. And that became great fun to watch, if not a little bit embarrassing for the Russians.
Well, exactly. So, you know, so that was, initially it was just some of the athletes sending out messages around the village of half, you know, half finished
double toilet.
The double toilet was one of them. You know, rooms without windows, those kind of things that we saw, and it was everyone poking a bit of fun, but you know, it did get people to tune into the coverage and follow the Olympics a little bit more. And then, yeah, obviously when you start something like that, it does become a meme, and then everyone starts sort of piling on. Everyone wants to be a jokester, but yeah, it's part of the fun side of it.
Two things before we go. The rise of the podcast, which yep. seems like a bit of an old-fashioned technology these days because things move so quickly, but it is growing.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for a technology to be, you know, to be 7 to 8 years old, to be on the rise all of a sudden, it is quite strange, but it definitely has, you know, I'm a podcaster myself, but the last 6 months has seen, you know, one, the press are talking about it. I think part of it is great content. So there's podcasts like Serial, which is, you know, I liken it to, you know, 2000, you know, TV's version of Lost, you know, the fact that it's water cooler kind of stuff. If you haven't looked it up, it's a crime drama and what happens next. And I won't give any spoiler alerts, but, 5 million downloads in like 7 episodes. So it's that kind of thing. So podcasting has shown that once you're in, and then you want to find others. So definitely something to keep an eye on.
And just finally, in terms of future tech, I've got a minute to go. So the wearable watch, the Apple Watch, will it work?
Yeah.
Give me a geek prediction. Are people going to wear this thing and use it?
I think there'll be people, there'll be lines that people will wear it because there's that many Apple fanboys out there. But I don't know if it's going to be a thing because I don't think it provides any more value than your smartphone.
But you really look like Dick Tracy.
Or you could just shorten that and without the Tracy bit. You don't need the phone. I've got my clock on my phone. It has everything. So I'm not sure. I'm not convinced myself.
Good on you, Sean. Good to talk to you, mate.
Did you know Sports Geek Podcast has listeners in over 50 countries? Thank you for sharing.
Thanks again to Francis Leach for having me back for another good year of ABC Grandstand. It's great to be on the national broadcaster once a week, and you can tune in every Saturday morning to hear me talk about that live or via the apps and via streaming, and you can catch it around the world when I'm on. But follow my tweets and you'll know when I'm on in your part of the world. At Sean Callanan is where you can find me. That wraps up this episode of the Sports Geek Podcast, episode 71. Thank you again to my guest, Fiona Green, for talking CRM. Let us know what you think and send us a tweet on your thoughts on both the discussion I had with Fiona and also some trends for 2015. Athletes, podcasting, do you agree? Also did a really good podcast on trends on beers, blokes and business where we discussed a whole bunch of trends for 2015. You can find that at beersblokesbusiness.com. Also, on the Sports Geek podcast page, you can now leave a voicemail or an audio question. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/SGP. I'd love some testimonials telling people where you're listening from and who you work for. Or just fire a question and I'll do my best to answer it on a future podcast. Just go to sportsgeekhq.com. Q.com/SGP and click on the record now. Until then, my name is Sean Callanan from SportsGeekHQ.com and you've been listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.
Check out which teams work with Sports Geek at SportsGeekHQ.com/clients. Find all Sports Geek podcasts at SportsGeekHQ.com/SGP. Send in your sounds of the game. Email Sean at sportsgeekhq.com. Thanks for listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.